Well, if you're lucky, your health is usually pretty good and you don't have to focus too much on it. But when you're suddenly not feeling well, it can be stressful, especially when it's not clear what is causing the problem. And the same is true when your pet is under the weather. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine is our guest. She takes time each month to spend with us to give us advice on keeping our pets happy and healthy. And Sandy, great to have you back.
It is so nice to be back on this beautiful day.
It is a wonderful day. And I tell you what, we've got so much to talk about. You were visiting with me before the show about common reasons for visits to the veterinarian.
Yes, every year there's a pet insurance company, VPI, that does a survey, and this was 2012's results. Can you guess what the, you've been doing this show long enough, what do you think the number one thing is that dogs go into the veterinarian for?
Oh, let's see.
I mean, we're talking illness now, not wellness stuff.
And I was thinking maybe he bit somebody.
No, last month was dog bite prevention month. And so, you know, and hopefully we're not going to have any more of that. But the number one thing is skin problems, skin allergies, ear infections, and so on. And, you know, when we...
I should have known that with your dogs.
Yeah, I know. With all the calls we get, I mean, I would bet that on most of the calls we're going to have today are going to involve, you know, dogs that are itchy, because we're heading into allergy season. And you even started the show by saying that we may talk about food allergies too, because there's a lot of misconceptions about that. But, you know, other things, arthritis and so on, and periodontal disease is in the top 10 as well. So, you know, things that we could do to help prevent some of this is keep our pets lean, brush your pet's teeth, get regular veterinary care, and, you know, for skin infections and allergies, getting them treated early and you know, really, it takes a lot of commitment from the owner and realize it's probably going to be lifetime. What do you think it is for cats?
Cats, let's see. What would it be for cats? Eye issues?
Well, that was up on the list, okay? In fact, it was number 10, okay? So for problems with respiratory and eye problems, the number one, which I was really surprised at, is a bladder infection.
Yeah.
Bladder infections in cats are really uncommon. When we see bladder infections, when I'm talking you can culture bacteria from the urine. When we have a cat that comes in that's under 10 years of age that has blood in their urine, less than 2% of those actually have a urinary tract infection. Older cats that have something like diabetes or kidney disease where their urine is not as concentrated, so they don't have that natural protection mechanism, much more common. So I have to probably, you know, slap VPI's, you know, writer on the hand and say, why did you put it as bladder infection? It probably should have just been, you know, bladder problems, because the majority of cats that we see coming in that are under 10 either have bladder stones or just an inflamed bladder from being stressed or whatever, and it's not actually an infection. So I rarely ever throw antibiotics at a cat unless I've actually got a culture to show that it's positive for bacteria.
You mentioned allergies, and I've sort of promoted food allergies as an issue, and certainly we're seeing more and more food allergies in people. Are you seeing the same increase with dogs and cats?
Not really, but unfortunately, a lot of people read into what, you know, their pet is doing and assume that it is a food allergy. And in fact, food allergies account for about 5 to 10% of the dogs that are itchy. And this is just looking at dogs right now. It's you know, actually not as common as other things like flea allergy, dermatitis, and you know, allergies to things in the environment. But some of the myths that people have are that, you know, dogs are allergic to corn and grains. That's like the number one thing. And unfortunately, no, that isn't. But that's one of the reasons why I see a lot of people switching to these grain-free diets, because they think it's going to help their pet with their itching. First of all, you know, grains are there for a reason. They're part of a balanced diet in many cases. And it's kind of a fad for dogs to be going on these grain-free diets. And we know that the protein sources that are coming from animal-based protein are probably the number one thing. We also see people thinking, just like they jump on the bandwagon for human beings, the gluten thing. I mean, I walked into my local grocery store and they've now expanded the gluten-free aisle to huge. This is a huge section. And yet it is, you know, even though gluten is a protein, it is very uncommon. In fact, there's been no confirmed cases in dogs of gluten intolerance. So, it's, you know, so things that are out like that. If you really want to find out if your pet has a dietary allergy, first of all, treat the secondary infections first. Get rid of the yeast and bacteria and get them on flea prevention. After you've got that under control, then you can start a food trial. And that means no oral heartworm pills, no dog treats, no human food. You use a hydrolyzed protein diet and just that. Rather than jumping from one bag of food to another, you know, any food that you're going to pick up at the grocery store, even the ones that say limited antigen diets, which you think would be perfect for dogs that have food allergies, they may be manufactured in a plant that is making other things that contains the products that the dogs are allergic to. Kind of like people that are allergic to peanuts, the fact that a product is made in a factory where peanuts have been processed, that dust could still be there and cause a problem. So you really need to go with one of the veterinary prescribed diets that you know are going to be containing nothing that the dog will react to. And it takes a good several weeks. We're looking at a minimum of 2 months, if not 3, to be able to find out whether it's going to work or not.
Wow. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. If you have a question for her, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question, a comment, and a photo there as well. We'd love to hear from you. What, do we have any symptoms with food allergies?
Well, most of the dogs that have symptoms are, I call it the ears and rears. They're itchy. Their ears, their feet, and so on, just like they can be for allergies to other things like pollens and molds and house dust mites and so on. But some dogs with food allergies will also have some gastrointestinal signs where they may have some diarrhea. It's not always linked hand in hand. So just because the dog doesn't have intestinal signs doesn't mean that you can rule out a food allergy. Yeah. So that's, I mean, it's just the, you know, if you want to really truly find out if your dog has food allergies after you've gone through the trial, then you have to challenge them with various protein sources. So we have chicken week and tofu week and beef week to see if we can figure out what the dog is actually allergic to. So it's a huge commitment.
Well, we have some callers online. Let's see if we can get Jackie up here. Jackie in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a 10-year-old Chihuahua Jack Russell who was diagnosed with a rectal cancer a year ago in June, given 2 months to live. He is happy. He's not healthy, but he's doing well. But to give him pills is a fight. I almost have to choke him. Is there some way to process pills or make them into a liquid, or what can you do?
Yeah, what a great question. There are more and more veterinary formulating pharmacies showing up that can find your dog's favorite flavor, whether it be, you know, Tutti Frutti, bubblegum, chicken, tuna. But there's all, you know, and certain flavors hide different medications better. And that would be one of the things to talk to your veterinarian about is, can we get this medication formulated into something that's going to make it easier for my pet to take it? I have a patient that is a cat patient that is on heart medication, refuses to take pills, and we work with a formulating pharmacy that actually turns them into little chewable treats. And that has worked very well. They come, you know, in little cards of like 10 little treats that they just pop out and the cat gets their medication that way. Another thing that's available over the counter that you may have already tried is using the pill pockets. The company called the Greenie Company has made these little, they almost look like shot glass type things, little miniature things that come in different sizes and flavors. They're real squishy and smelly, and you can sometimes hide the pill in there and the dog will down it without a problem. But all it takes is them biting into it once in case if it's a real bitter medication. And they may avoid that. To be honest with you, I could have to tell you what I've been doing for my dogs who are on twice daily medication. It's one of two things. I either, and please. I don't recommend this to anybody that unless you talk to your vet first, but my dogs absolutely adore Ready Whip, okay? Yes, okay? A can of Ready Whip, a little dab. I mean, all it takes is making that little sound, like that squirt sound of the whipped cream coming out, and like a half a teaspoon, put the pill in it, and down it goes. And they hear that, and they come running to the kitchen to take their medication, well, hobbling to the kitchen to take their medication. I had another lady in today with a 17-year-old cockapoo who's, you know, we're talking end-of-life type stuff, and when we're medicating this dog, the only way she can get her dog to take medication is to coat it in butter. And obviously, we're not going to be giving this dog half a stick of butter to take the medication, but just enough to be able to kind of coat the outside and keep that powder from dissolving in the dog's mouth. So, you know, sometimes you have to resort to special things, peanut butter and different things like that. But if you've tried all that, then work with your veterinarian through a formulating pharmacy.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Jackie. Oh, so Ready Whip.
Oh, yes. You know, and I'm just as guilty as the next person, and you try everything. I mean, she won't take it in peanut butter, and I've tried it in, you know, wrapping it up in cheese and wrapping it up in, like, turkey lunch meat. And, you know, and it gets to that point where I'm tired of seeing pills on the floor. She needs her medication to be able to keep mobile, and that seems to do the trick. So,
well, there may be some other
And people. plus, Mark likes to take a squirt in his mouth. That's my partner who I live with, you know, and so I can hear him in the kitchen dishing up the pills, and all of a sudden, and I'm like, yeah, I can walk in, and he's got a mouthful of whipped cream. So,
well, you might have sold some whipped cream.
There we go.
Today.
Yeah.
Brenda in Green Bay, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi, and hello to both of you, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 4-year-old Weimaraner who was just diagnosed in April with immune mediated polyarthritis.
Okay.
And she's on a prednisone treatment, and it really. It's like her system is so sensitive. Is there a different way that I can treat her with that? And also, I've gotten conflicting stories about vaccinating her now.
Well, I'm going to answer your last question first. Because we don't know what the trigger is for many dogs that develop immune-mediated diseases, whether this be an immune-mediated joint problem or perhaps a bone marrow problem affecting the platelets or the red blood cells, those are dogs that I would not be vaccinating. I would be recommending that you check titers, which is a measure of the body's immune response. Many, many dogs, once they've received vaccines several times, are well immunized for an extended period of time. The problem we have, though, is when those titers drop to recognizably unprotected levels, what are we going to do? And that could potentially be a problem. But, you know, I do recommend, you know, avoiding vaccinations. We're really lucky in our community here that animal control will actually provide dog licenses to people that can show that their dog has a rabies titer that's protective, a letter from us saying that, you know what, we don't want to be vaccinating this dog because of its health issues. So they're still able to be licensed and be recognized as a, you know, legal dog citizen in the and cat citizen in our community. So it might be something you're going to have to petition with your veterinarian about if that's a problem in your community. When it comes to medication, there are some other medications that are immunosuppressive drugs that are may still fall in the steroid category, but may be easier on your dog's system. There's one, I have one dog right now that's on a drug called budesonide and seems to be tolerating it much better than prednisone. We'll also see other medications that are typically used for things like, you know, chemotherapy and so on, but at different dosages to help control these dogs. So don't think that Pred is the only way to go. That does tend to have more side effects. Start looking into some of these other medications with your veterinarian, and hopefully your dog will have some relief.
All right. Great. Thanks. Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Gabby Pedriani, our on-air producer today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for listening in today. Questions? Give us a call. 1-800-642-1234. Tom and Nina, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, my dog always eats grass. why is he doing that? Is he missing something in his diet, or why do they do that?
Well, my pat answer for this problem is your dog probably just likes a salad now and then. I have a dog that does the same thing. She goes out, loves to eat grass. You just have to be careful that that is not, treated with pesticides or anything that could be a problem for your dog. There are dogs that just like to eat it. That they like that the long, you know, really fresh kind of, chewy grass. But some dogs will go out if eating the grass is also accompanied by vomiting, diarrhea, decreased appetite for their dinner. They may have learned that eating grass can act as a purgative. They eat enough of it and they may vomit. And that you have to just know what your dog's doing. If it's just they're just out there enjoying themselves, I'd say don't worry too much about it. I have seen dogs though consume so much grass that they ended up with a grass impaction in their intestinal tract and actually required endoscopy to go in and start pulling all this grass out so that everything can get back to normal function again. So, you know, you still have to be watchful. Even if the dog is healthy and happy, they may still overdo it.
There you go. Thanks, Tom. In other words, we don't know. Except
we don't
know.
Yeah, there's companies that make food supplements. There's one company that makes a product called Barley Grass, which is dried, ground up barley grass. And they're like, oh, yeah, you put this on your dog's food and it'll cure their grass eating problem. But I've not had much success with it. So I think it's more just knowing where your dog is eating and watching for any other symptoms.
Anna in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. My husband and I have a 7-year-old Schnauzer poodle mix, and we kennel her during the day while we're at work, and she tears apart anything that we put in her kennel, beds, blankets, towels, and I guess I'm just wondering what can we do to help calm her down?
Well, the question is, why is she doing it? Is it because she has separation anxiety and she, is feeling very distressed when she's in her kennel? And it brings up the question, why do you kennel her as a 7-year-old dog?
Well, when we first moved into our house 3 years ago, we left her just in the kitchen because we weren't sure how she would react in the new house. And she ended up eating or tearing pieces of the linoleum up, tearing at a bag that was on the floor, that kind of stuff. So my husband actually worked from home for about a year and a half, so then she wasn't kenneled for a year and a half. And then when he started leaving for work, we put her back in her kennel and we just did it as a precaution.
Yeah, and, I get concerned when we have a dog that is destructive like this. Is it just they're bored and this is fun to just shred stuff? I mean, I've been in staff meetings where I've seen someone taking, coffee stirrers and breaking it up into a bunch of little pieces or, ripping a sheet of paper apart just because they're bored and it's something to do. Or is the fact that she is really stressed? Is she, you being gone and her being in a kennel? So a couple things you may want to do. One would be either videotape or audio tape her to see, is she barking? Is she pacing and crying and panting? Is she actually acting distressed? If you have a hard time getting her to go in her kennel and, she starts recognizing the fact that you're getting ready to leave because you're putting your shoes on, you're putting your coat on and her eyes are getting wide and she's panting and, maybe goes into her kennel unwillingly. Or maybe when you get home, she's just hyper excited. She's so glad that you're home. Those are all symptoms of dogs that have some type of separation anxiety. We can deal with this a number of ways. There are medications that say help with dealing with anxiety. Some of them are over-the-counter things that are kind of natural calmatives. There's other prescription drugs that you would be able to get from your veterinarian. One's called Clomacom. The other one is called Reconcile. Those are two labeled drugs for treating separation anxiety in dogs. Sometimes giving them the benefit of a dog appeasement pheromone. I wouldn't put a collar on her since she's in a kennel, but plugging in one of the atomizers that sometimes will take the edge off of them a little bit. But it basically comes down to behavior modification. Training your dog that going into the kennel and you walking out the door doesn't mean that the world is going to come to an end. And there's a whole program on how to desensitize the dog to departure cues and you gradually getting ready to leave. It takes a long time. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. But that would be something that between you and your veterinarian and some medication and maybe an applied animal behaviorist, you can get under control.
Mm-hmm.
Just one more quick question. So if it is separation anxiety, do we need to be concerned if we didn't kennel her that she might destroy something in the house?
Well, that's just it. I mean, if it is anxiety, they're going to be, you know, starting, they may destroy the couch or scratch at the door. I mean, I've had dogs break teeth, rip claws out, jump through windows, tear down curtains. I mean, it can be very extreme. And I don't know without actually, you know, videotaping your dog and seeing what your dog is like in the kennel. I mean, if she's sleep, just gets in the kennel and lays down and has a nap, and then a few hours later wakes up and maybe she hears the UPS truck go by or the doorbell ring, that may be enough to get her agitated that she starts digging and chewing. So there may be a trigger that is not related to being left alone. So I think getting some more information on your part, and this would be getting a good behavioral history, and it can take a good hour to sit down with someone and actually get a good behavioral history. So, but if you can get her videotape, that's going to be the first thing to be able to help with getting to the bottom of why this is happening.
Good luck, Anna. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Carol in Oak Creek. Hello.
Hi. Thank you. I have a corgi dog who is approximately 10 years old and had an unusual episode last week, and the vet can't find anything wrong with him. He was lying on the floor and he got up to walk, and he started to tremble severely and stagger and walk like he was drunk. He couldn't get his balance. The test revealed nothing. The vet prescribed Rimadyl, but I'm afraid of giving him Rimadyl because I had another dog die after giving him Rimadyl. And the vet doesn't know what's wrong with my current dog, so I really don't know what to do.
Yeah, I'm not sure what your dog was doing. It may be that a couple of things that may have had a partial seizure. 10-year-old dog, you know, when we start seeing epilepsy occurring at that point, we start thinking of more evil things like brain tumors and so on. But they can sometimes be totally normal between seizure episodes. And so that, you know, would be the case in with your dog, in that you went to the vet after this episode and they didn't find anything. A thorough neurologic examination, looking in the retinas, getting some blood work done to make sure that your dog wasn't hypoglycemic or having some other, you know, abnormality that could have caused that episode of weakness. But the fact that it stopped right away tells me that, you know, it was it just a, you know, a brief seizure episode?
It was about 4 minutes.
Yeah, and that's very classic for a dog that is having a seizure, is it lasting for, you know, 2 to 5 to 10 minutes, kind of in that range, and then they snap out of it. So if you came in to my clinic with that kind of history, I would be doing a full neurologic exam, getting at least a geriatric chem panel done to make sure everything's fine. I doubt I would be prescribing a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. That's typically used for pain. It's not something that we would be using for a seizure disorder, unless your veterinarian thinks that the staggering was because of some joint issues or something going on. Rimadyl can be used very safely, but you always want to make sure that you have pre-treatment blood work done. Then after they've been on it for a little bit, recheck some blood work, especially in that older patient, to make sure that their body's tolerating it. There's still going to be the odd dog that has that liver issue that can occur with it that's unpredictable. It's rare, and I'm sorry that you had a dog that had problems with it, but you know, but I don't understand why it was prescribed. So I'd maybe go back to your veterinarian and just say, you know, hey, you know, did you really think this is necessary?
Mm-hmm.
So I need a specialist, basically, because he was very subdued and lethargic after this episode. He was not himself. This is more than a muscle spasm, and the vet thought, oh, your dog maybe just was stiff getting up. But no, this dog was...
Yeah. And that after effect, if your dog did have a seizure, we call that the post-ictal or post-seizure phase. They can be a very lethargic and almost, you know, like antisocial and non-responsive to their normal things. They're not the normal self, and it can last for minutes to hours to sometimes days, depending on the severity of the seizure.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Anne in Stanley coming up next, but you can join in too if you have a question or comment. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or post a comment or a photo on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Ann and Stanley, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Good morning, Dr. Sawchuk. Good morning, Larry.
Good
Thank
morning.
You for this program. It's very informative. I have an 8-year-old chocolate lab whose protein count is elevated. He is also being treated for Lyme's. He is on doxycycline. I make his dog food, so he gets homemade cooked dog food. My veterinarian suggested that I get a protein mineral type of mix to add to the food that I give to him. It's a special diet of some sort to get his protein count under control. She said that I can get it at pet food stores. She didn't know a name of anything, and that was all she gave me. Can you give me a little bit more information as to what I should look for? Should I be making his, she said one of the options was that we could give him a commercially processed dog food such as Hill's, prescription diet of some sort.
So the question is, why is his protein up? I mean, and what protein is it? Is it the albumin level, his globulin level? Do you know which level it is?
I apologize. She did not tell me. She just said his protein level was elevated, it was up, and that if I'm going to make his food at home, I need to get this vitamin protein mix to add to his homemade dog food.
Well, I think we're dealing with a couple of different issues here. One, you need to get a diagnosis and find out, because we'll see protein levels going up in dogs that are just mildly dehydrated. We'll see protein levels going up in dogs that have cancer, like multiple myeloma, will cause their globulin levels sometimes to certain values to peak. Sometimes the protein levels will go up with different infections. There's a whole host of things that can be causing this. It's rarely diet. The diet, when we have a pet on a diet, the protein content of the food usually doesn't affect your albumin and globulin level that much, unless you're like in total starvation type diet. But the fact that you're making a homemade diet is really interesting, because there was just a good review article published in the AVMA journal, and this was just published June 1st, so it's kind of fresh and hot off the press, and it was looking just at evaluating home-prepared recipes for dogs, not cats, but just dogs. And they looked at 200 recipes that were obtained from 34 different sources. And of these recipes, they found that 64% of them were actually written by veterinarians. And they either came from books, online recipes, and so on. And that 33.5% actually came from other sources, non-veterinarians. And when they looked at the evaluation of these diets, and they did this with a computer evaluation as well as laboratory quantification to see, did they meet the dog's needs? Are they getting everything that the dog needs to be able to have all the essential nutrients? What they found is that very, very few of these recipes, including the ones written by veterinarians, met the dog's nutritional needs, and that they were nutritionally deficient. And so the summary of this is that if you are going to come up with a home-prepared diet, what they said here is that it requires an expert input to minimize the risk of problems, and we recommend that recipes for home-prepared diets for dogs be obtained or evaluated by a board-certified veterinary nutritionist, not just your veterinarian. I can't even look at a diet and tell you whether it's good or not. This really needs the help of an expert. And so I don't know if your homemade diet is adequate or not. My guess is no. So one of the things that I'll tell people to do is, go to the American College of Veterinary Nutritionists. I think that's what it is. But they will list veterinary nutritionists that will help with doing diet evaluation. There are some commercial sites available as well. There's one called balanceit.com that will provide you with recipes. These are made by board-certified veterinary nutritionists. They also are selling their own supplement. But that is something that at least you know that you're going to have your dog on a well-balanced diet, and that will rule out whether diet is causing your dog's problems or not.
Hmm. Would I then be better off to just go with the Hill's prescription commercially processed food?
Well, I always think that rather than having a diet that's deficient, I think that the commercial diets, especially if you're dealing with the companies that we know do food trials and testing, there are many foods out there that will just say formulated to meet AFCO standards, American Association of Feed Control Officials. That means that they could make that diet and never actually feed it to a pet. And I can walk through the pet store and point out dozens of diets that are like that. I like to see that they've actually gone through feeding trials. And so Hill's would be one of the companies, Nestle, Purina, Iams, Waltham, you know, those are kind of the big names that come to mind right now. I know that they actually feed it to dogs and see how they do from birth to death, or, and you know, to middle age, and they put the dogs up for adoption. So that's what I would like to see in a diet. And I think you're always better off than using a diet that is not well balanced.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, Chris in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks for a great show, as always.
Appreciate it.
I'm calling about my cat, Martha. I found her as a stray, and so I don't know her exact age, but I've had her for 15 years, and she was fully grown when I found her. So we think she's at least 16. And she seems, for a cat of her age, she seems otherwise healthy, but I had some teeth pulled a couple months ago, and she's sneezed since then and possibly before that, but I just thought she just sneezed. And the vet is more concerned because it's continued that she might have bronchitis.
Well, sneezing isn't going to be a symptom of bronchitis. Sneezing is more upper respiratory in the nose area. Bronchitis is down in the lungs. And so what you would see down there is wheezing and coughing and so on. So I'm a little confused why your veterinarian is thinking that it could be bronchitis causing this. The fact that she was sneezing after or around the time that she had some dental disease that was serious enough to require extractions, one of the things that I get concerned about is sometimes we will have periodontal disease that is so severe that you'll start getting bone loss around the tooth that can actually extend up into the nasal cavity. And we call those oral nasal fistulas, a hole that is connected between the mouth and the nose. And I don't know if at the time of dentistry, X-rays were done or anything was done to confirm, you know, the viability of the bone surrounding the teeth that were being extracted. But that might be something to be going back to and just saying, was this related to the dental disease? Could that be what's causing it? But other things that could be causing sneezing in a cat besides that would be you know, foreign bodies in the nose, if they've inhaled something, a nasal tumor, a nasal infection, sinusitis, something like that. And so, you know, then you're going down the road of the nasal extravaganza, which may require, you know, a CT scan of the skull and rhinoscopy and cytology and going down all that path. And I know that the one of the things that people get concerned about when they're dealing with an older pet is how far do you go with doing a workup? And that's, you know, the owner's personal choice. Just remember that age isn't a disease. We will see cats that are 15, 16 years of age that are in great physical shape, have normal blood work, everything is fine, and they can handle procedures like this just fine. So, but it does take doing that preliminary work to make sure that your cat is a suitable candidate to have other anesthetic procedures and things done.
Oh, and so they did x-rays at the time of the extraction, and that's why they took two teeth where originally they were going to just take one. She seemed to come through that with pretty much flying colors. You know, she went through the anesthesia and everything. And I guess for me, you know, when I've heard what they need to do in order to take the vet to look into the sort of bronchitis or respiratory something, he wanted to do a chest x-ray. And I thought of that like a human chest x-ray where, oh, yeah, no big deal. But thinking with a pet where, no, they have to knock them out. They have to sort of strap them down. You know, it's a very invasive thing.
Yeah, chest x-rays, it really depends on the temperament of the patient. The majority of dogs and cats, you can do radiographs, x-rays, awake without any trouble. If you have a cat that is really highly fractious, it may take some sedation, rarely full anesthesia to be able to get an x-ray. But, you know, most of the time, if the handlers are wearing a leather apron and leather gloves, they can position them and have their own extremities protected so that the x-ray beam is just going through the cat and not through them. So I'm uncertain why your veterinarian is saying that that has to be done under sedation or anesthesia, unless it has something to do with the temperament of your cat. But it sounds like Martha may be a very sweet girl, and yeah. I'm a little confused.
Yeah, no, she's very sweet, and the vet didn't say that she had to be knocked out. I've heard that from
other people.
Oh, other people. Well, that's what you get for listening to Dr. Google, you know? So I think that if your veterinarian is concerned enough about what's going on by listening to the chest and the symptoms your cat may have, by all means, an x-ray of the chest is a very non-invasive procedure and is going to provide you and your veterinarian with lots of information to be able to help your cat.
Good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Chris. Lynette in Hubertus, hi to you.
Hi. I had a comment regarding the person who called earlier with the dog that exhibited seizure symptoms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I had a senior dog that same thing happened. I thought she was having a stroke. I mean, it was heartbreaking to watch. But what it turned out to be was vestibular something that starts with a D, vestibular something. And the remedy was, just to make her more comfortable, was meclizine.
Mm-hmm.
To alleviate some of that vertigo feeling. And she never had it again, although I know it could have happened again, but it didn't. It was just that one-time incident.
Mm-hmm. And that is another common problem in older dogs. And we call the name that we give that is old dog vestibular disease. And it's one of these things where we don't know what the cause is. It just comes on acutely where the dog loses its balance. Their eyes are flicking. They may be rolling. They may be nauseated. It's kind of like they just got off the tilt-a-whirl. And with, just supportive care, usually within a few days, these dogs can be back to normal. What the owner of the dog that called earlier was describing was a period where the dog was wobbly and really shaky for about 4 minutes, then got over that and then was just really depressed afterwards, which typically is what we would see with a seizure because of the fact that it came and went so quickly, rather than old dog vestibular disease, which is going to last for days before the dog comes back to normal. So yeah. That's how I kind of got to that diagnosis, rather than thinking of vestibular disease. But you're right, a lot of dogs that get this vestibular problem, there's people will start thinking that their dog is having some type of a vascular accident or a stroke, which is fairly uncommon in dogs. And I think, unfortunately, many dogs lose their life because, you know, owners are unaware that this is something that they, even though it looks hard on them for a couple of days, with supportive care, using drugs to help stop that tilt-a-whirl-like feel, they can get back to normal and may have a little bit of residual head tilt, but usually bounce right back.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for calling, Lynette. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Sandy, we've had a comment from Carol in Wales who is referencing a comment you made about whipped cream.
Oh, yeah. And you have to be careful. Anytime you're using human foods for pets, is it safe for the pet? Dogs are very sensitive to, there's some artificial sweeteners that are out there. There's in particular xylitol, which can cause them to have their blood sugar drop to extremely low levels and cause liver disease and can actually cause death in very small amounts. And so, you know, if you're going to be using human foods to be able to bribe your pet into taking medication, just make sure that it's a safe one to consider using.
Michael in Hubertus says he's going to take his dog camping. I'm wondering what types of vaccines should he be looking for to get for the dog?
Yeah, you know, it really depends. If this is just going to be kind of a one-time deal and you're going to be heading out, and it depends on when you're leaving. If you're going to be going camping this weekend, there is no vaccine that's going to be working that quickly to provide your dog with that great of an immune response. Most vaccines are going to take at least two doses, 2 to 3 weeks apart, and then a couple of weeks after that last one, you can be pretty comfortable that the dog has some good immunity. Things that I would be concerned about would be if the dog is going to be around water, standing water or anything like that, leptospirosis should be part of this dog's vaccination program. And again, that requires two doses and annual boosters. It's a bacteria that's spread through the urine of a lot of wildlife, raccoons, skunks, rats, deer, cattle. That's not wildlife, but
beavers.
You know, yeah, anything like that. And then the other one would be Lyme disease. And Lyme vaccine is available as well. But we are seeing equal numbers of other tick-borne diseases. And so the best thing you can do to prevent Lyme disease is practice good tick control using topical products, spot-on products, or even some of the new collars that are out there that are effective at keeping ticks off the dog, and doing daily tick surveillance and get those ticks off before they have a chance to transmit disease.
Nancy says our 9-year-old male border collie has been refusing all foods. We've been to the vet many times, tried many different foods. I just can't find anything that works. What should I do?
Well, when we have an appetite problem like this, I really get worried that this dog is trying to tell them something, that they're ill for some reason. So rather than just trying different foods, I hope that they have done some at least minimal database workup, getting a urine sample checked, blood cell counts checked, a thorough physical exam, chemistry evaluation, to find out what is going on with this dog. Because, you know, a dog that's been eating all their life that suddenly just goes off of food totally usually has some type of underlying illness that needs to be addressed. And hopefully they can get that treated and find out, you know, what the dog wants to eat again after that.
Mike in Oshkosh, hello to you.
Hi, good morning, Larry. Good morning, Darker.
Morning.
How are you doing? My question is I have a she's going to be 2 years old, golden retriever. Usually a real good-natured dog. I have some small children that play with her, and sometimes she'll kind of snarl, like show her teeth, but no growl to it. Just kind of her lips will go up and show her teeth, but, you know, never really aggressive. But the other last night, my son dropped Steel Loaf on the floor, and when he went to retrieve it, she bit him in the arm.
Oh.
And first time she's ever really been aggressive with food, and I've even, you know, every once in a great while, we'll reach down to her dish while she's eating, you know, just for that fact to make sure she's, you know, got that under control, because the kids do drop food sometimes. And I'll be honest, my first reaction was to yell at her, and I gave her a couple slaps in the rear. And I know that's probably not the best or most effective, mm-hmm. but it was just, you know, an emotional reaction. My 4-year-old was, you know, she bit him hard enough instead of bruised. You know, his
Yeah.
I could give her two little swats, you know.
And yeah.
Terrible, but
I get, you know, a couple of things I would be doing anytime we've had an episode like this where you know what the cause was, food going on the floor. The best advice I can say is practice avoidance. She probably should not be around people when they are eating. And until, you know, you've got her, you know, on a good down stay, a sit stay, you know that you've got her well controlled, just have her out of the room. Put her in her kennel, put her in the laundry room when food is being prepared or served. And some of this is going to be training your 4-year-old that you just don't have a snack around the dog, because you never know when that's going to be a problem. And, you know, food competition, food aggression, my own example of, and I always wonder why people want to put their hands in their dog's food or take the food away to see what the dog would do. Imagine being in a wonderful restaurant and you're sitting and enjoying the food, and all of a sudden the waiter comes by and says, "You're done with that, aren't you?" and takes the food away. And you're like, "No, don't take it. I paid for that." You know, you're going to probably be a little angry and maybe a little assertive yourself because you want that back. I think, you know, teaching her to wait before she is able to eat, making sure that she is not in an anxious state at eating, that is someone going to come by and try to take my food away from me, you know, have mealtimes for her become this calm event. So having her sit stay, down stay, you know, wait, the food gets presented, and then, okay, you can eat. We're going to leave you alone so that you're not in this anxious stress state. That may help. So it's going to mean probably working with a trainer, an applied animal behaviorist, if you don't have that kind of training under your belt. But in the meantime, she has to be out of the kitchen or dining room when you're eating. Yeah, hitting her probably wasn't the best thing, but boy, when it's your child being bit, I don't blame you. I mean, that's, right. That's just your natural reaction, so don't beat yourself up over that. But I, you know, I think this would be a very solvable problem, when at least when it comes with the food. I'm concerned, though, about your other comment that there are times where she is lifting her lip and showing her teeth. There's a couple of reasons why dogs will do that. Some dogs will do what's called a submissive grin, where they're just very subordinate, very submissive, and they're, you know, wagging their tail, and they're doing the little, you know, like, I'm a weenie dog, and, you know, and they lift their lip up, and just kind of the front, there's no, the lips aren't pulled back, their eyes aren't hard, and all you see is like that little, you know, grin, and then they're right back to being normal again. That's kind of a cute thing because it's indicating the dog is super submissive and friendly. And I love seeing dogs that do that kind of submissive grin or smile. But I would not be able to, with just what you've told me, interpret, is your dog doing that kind of submissive grin, or is your dog actually doing facial displays of, don't come any closer, I don't want you to touch me, I don't want you near me, and is giving that body language warning that could escalate to the next step. And that's where you're going to really need to get some professional help.
Yeah, an applied animal behaviorist.
I think that would be your best bet. Trainers are great at training, but behaviorists are good at reading body language and helping you with getting down to the bottom of this.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. Becky in Sheboygan, your turn. Hi, Becky.
Hi, I'm calling. We have a 9-year-old golden retriever chow mix that we adopted from the Humane Society when he was 4. And we were told that he was great with kids, and he has been. We have a 3-year-old and an 18-month-old, and he's totally fine with them. He, you know, if they kind of bother him or climb on him, he just gets up and walks away. He's never been aggressive or anything towards him or towards them. But we were at the vet this morning, and I took the 2 kids with me. And at the vet, he's kind of like Jekyll and Hyde. He was aggressive towards the vet, and, you know, we couldn't get him muzzled, and we ended up having to sedate him. And so the vet was kind of concerned about how he was with the kids. And, you know, I explained to her how he was. And she made the comment about, you know, as they get older, to kind of, like, she noticed he was protecting them, which I guess she said was a sign of dominance. And she just said to kind of watch as they get older, if they challenge his dominance, and to kind of be careful with that. And I guess I don't totally understand the pack mentality.
And I would kind of take that pack mentality stuff and throw it in the trash can, okay? Your dog sounds like it's behaving appropriately at home. Kid, you know, and you need to be there to supervise your kids. Never leave young children like that alone with the dog, because anything can happen. I had somebody come in, their kid got bit in the face, and I said, well, what happened? Well, my son likes to touch my dog's eyeball, and he's always done it, and the dog never did anything but walk away. Finally, the dog just said, I've had enough. You hurt me, I bit, and got bit. So, you know, you need to be there to supervise, but it sounds like your dog's doing behaviorally appropriate at home, getting up and walking away when they've had enough. Perfect. At the vet clinic, totally different story. We do things to dogs. There's smells there. They're confined. We're leaning over them. Most of the dogs that I see coming into me are not dominant, not controlling, but it's fearful. They are just terrified. And so you see dilated pupils, you know, their tail may be tucked. And so those would be, you know, signs of what you need to work on is desensitizing the dog to going to the vet clinic. First of all, don't bring your kids. Leave the kids at home. That's not a safe environment to be with a dog that's upset like that. Then start having happy visits to the vet. You don't do anything except walk into the vet clinic, take some treats, and walk out. Walk into the exam room. They get some treats. They may give your dog a pat on the head. You walk out. those would be the things that you need to be working on. Unfortunately, sometimes we just have to get the job done when we're there, and it may require sedation to be able to work with the dog. But I think this is something you could work on with your veterinarian. I wouldn't worry about your kids.
So a clinic clinics will typically say, okay, yeah, you can bring the dog in.
Oh, we do it all the time. And we have dogs. I just get, you know, a page, and we keep cookies at the front desk. Sometimes just a matter of me coming into the exam room without a lab coat on and saying hi to the dog. And the dog's like, wow, I know this person, but she's not in her vet role today. And I will be glad to play ball with her. We'll have tennis balls. We throw balls. We play. The dog leaves. If the owner is willing to put that much time in it, I am too, because it's going to make my job a lot easier.
Oh, wonderful. Becky?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Denise and Lamira, hi.
Hi there. I have a question about sneezing. Whenever we come home and my dog greets us, he sneezes on us.
Yeah, you know, and I've seen this before, and sometimes it's because maybe the dog had a respiratory infection at one time, and you were like, oh, you poor baby. And the dog learned just like sit means, you know, or, you know, hello, or, you know, you do something, you get something. Hey, I sneeze, I get attention. It may have to do with the fact that the dog is inhaling or doing something weird because they're so excited, but what a cool thing to put on cue. You can start training your dog to sneeze, and that'll be the best thing you can do for, like, your guests when you have a party the next time is watch this trick. I can get my dog to sneeze.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, our guest today, and she'll be with us right up until 12:30, by the way, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She's been with us. Oh, my goodness. How many years? Been a long time.
Long time. Yeah. 82, I think. 83.
That's a long time. And a whole lot longer, too, I hope. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. It's always stressful when your pet is ill or not feeling well. And with so much information out there, you go to look and maybe you go online. Things contradict each other. That's why I'm happy to have every month Dr. Sandy Sawchuk join us. She's with the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, always has great answers to your questions, and I hope you'll join in. If you have a question or comment about your dog or your cat, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. We'd love to hear from you that way as well. If you've got some photos, love to see those too. We did have a Facebook question, Sandy, from Angie, who says, I have 4 neutered, vaccinated cats, living in my barn. I treat them routinely for worms and fleas. However, they seem to be getting a lot of ticks. Any treatment to help keep ticks at bay?
Yes. And, you know, this is a really bad year for ticks. And a couple of things that she may want to look into. One is there's a new collar that is made by the Bayer company called the Seresto collar. It's unique in that it is safe for dogs and cats. And there are so few products out there that we can say that. It lasts for 8 months. And so if the cats are capable of wearing these collars, and they are breakaway, so if they do get caught on anything since they're outdoors, that increases their safety. That might be something to consider trying. The other would be the monthly spot-on treatments, like one of the fipronil-based products. There's Frontline Top Spot. There's a Surety by another company, Fipriguard. There's several that are out there that would be effective, but it does mean, you know, getting these cats once a month and putting this on their back. You'd probably want to keep them separated for a bit so they're not grooming each other, and that may be a problem with having 4 cats. So I'd say try the collar. I've been hearing really good things that it's very effective.
Shane in Unalaska has a question for you. Hi, Shane.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, my beautiful mutt, who is almost 12, for the last probably year and a half or two, every time he lays down, he will groan, and the groaning gets longer and more pathetic as he's getting older. And I don't know if he's just kind of being a grumpy old man or if he's in pain. I don't know if they express pain that way.
That is one of the ways they do express pain. And the fact that it's when he's laying down, it's probably his joints hurt. And, you know, and then, you know, if he's trying to get up, if you're noticing that he's, you know, it takes him a little bit longer to be able to get up and standing, or maybe he's a little bit slower going up and down the stairs. You know, dogs and cats express pain similar to what we do, but they're really good at hiding it as well. And it's this natural response. I kind of equate it to, if you look at, you know, animals out in the wild, if they were moaning and groaning and complaining that, oh, I'm weak, I'm sick, they're going to be prey for somebody else. And so they're somebody else's lunch. So they tend to try to hide symptoms of pain. We like sympathy. We like getting flowers and so on. They don't. And so when you start noticing even subtle things like this, like, you know, just that little bit of moan as they're laying down, that tells me that your dog probably needs some help. And there's lots of different treatment modalities out there that can be used for handling pain. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are appropriate for many dogs, but not all. That would be things like Rimadyl, Prevacox, Meloxicam. There's even a new Meloxicam type drug that is called Oracam, and it's a spray that just goes in their mouth. And I took it home and tried it on my dog, and really easy. You don't have to pill them. It's a transmucosal spray, and that, you know, seemed to do the trick for handling some arthritis. And so there are things like that you can do. There are other non-steroidal drugs that are not in that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory class, like Tramadol that we use, Neurontin is sometimes used. It's a whole host of things that we can try. And, you know, don't think that, you know, that just you have to do medication. Sometimes things like physical therapy may be helpful as well. And some of the alternative therapies like chiropractic and acupuncture are also great for some of these older dogs, and obviously are not going to be involving the use of drugs.
Right. Okay. Well, all thank right. you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Barb in Bell Center, hello to you.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one that's kind of related to the one before, although my dog is young. It's a pit bull lab mix. She's about he. And my last dog was a she. He's about 3 years old and was exhibiting pain in his rear section, stiff movement, and when he got off the couch, he cried. Very briefly, but did definitely cry. And I know pit bulls are very pain tolerant and do not show pain. So I know that it hurt him. The vet put him on one aspirin a day, which has worked. It's a buffered aspirin, normal, the normal size, whatever that is, 325 milligrams, whatever that is. And I'm wondering about the long-term use of buffered aspirin. It does the trick. When I took him off of it for a week, the pain re-exhibited. So I put him back on one aspirin in the morning. But I'm wondering if long-term that is okay.
Well, the big problem with using aspirin in dogs, it is in the class of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. So I've already talked about the fact that, you know, it can cause liver issues long-term, may worsen problems if they've got some underlying kidney disease. And so you do have to monitor, especially in older dogs that are more prone to having organ issues. The other problem with aspirin, which is why it's kind of fallen out of favor in the veterinary community, is that it is more ulcerogenic, meaning it causes more stomach ulcers even if you're using it in a buffered form. And so you have to be really careful with making sure that you're using the right dose for your dog, that it is given with a stomach full of food, not just with a treat or two, and be really watchful for any signs of gastrointestinal bleeding. And that would be dark, tarry stools, vomiting, you know, anything like that. I think that there are other safer medications that you can use. Obviously, they're going to be more expensive than buffered aspirin. I've just mentioned them with the last caller. And you know, I think this is something you need to talk with your veterinarian about, you know, why they prescribed aspirin rather than the drugs that are approved for dog use.
I'm sure he did it for a cost issue.
Cost issue, yeah. Well, if your dog is tolerating it fine and not, you know, no symptoms and is young, and I would say maybe periodically, at least once a year, get a little mini chem panel to look at liver and kidney and check a urine sample. If everything's going fine, then you can probably stay on it safely.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks, Barb. Welcome. Thank you for calling. An email from Lewis in La Crosse thinking about adopting a 1 to 2 year old cat. It's been spayed after having her first litter earlier this year. Any health or behavioral concerns that I should be aware of associated with that pregnancy?
No. In fact, the spaying is going to keep her from coming into heat. Probably the only health concern would be the fact that it lowers their metabolism. So you do have to be very watchful to keep her from becoming overweight. Obesity has just become a rampant problem in our pet population because of all the high-octane foods that are out there, and the fact that a lot of our pets are now, you know, living in our homes with us rather than out and working for a living. And so we're feeding them all this stuff, and they tend to put weight on pretty easily. So as long as you're being watchful for that, I think what a great way to, you know, have a cat that's already taken care of. You don't have to worry about it. So good luck.
And a comment from Kevin in Tomahawks. You recommended a tick collar on the last show. Just wanted to say it works fantastically. The ticks are dropping like flies.
Wonderful. And that's probably this Seresto collar. I don't jump on the bandwagon of very many products, but this is one that I'm quite happy with, and I hope to be for a long period of time.
So it's called Seresto?
Seresto. S-E-R-E-S-T-O.
S-E-R-E-S-T-O.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Ed in Waupaca has a comment or question there. Hi, Ed. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What's on your mind?
Well, we have an 8-year-old border collie named Maxine, and I was listening to the show where you were talking about the submissive smiles. We get the submissive smile from her probably 10 times a day when we wake up, when we get home. And my wife and I are terrible trainers. We have 7 acres, and she has the run of the property. But the problem is with my 4-year-old son. Ever since he was a baby, Maxine just does not like him. And there is snarling and spitting and showing teeth and being aggressive with him. She's never bitten him. She's never nipped him. When he runs around the yard, she'll hurt him. When he tries to get in the door, she'll block his way. He does not act aggressively with her. He doesn't pull her hair or bother her in any way. He never did. He's very respectful of her. And it's gotten to the point where he just ignores her because it happens so constantly. She's just constantly mad at him all the time. And it's like two kids fighting. And we know that she's jealous of him because we had her first and so on. But I just wondered if there's anything we could do. She's aggressive up to a point with him and herds him and kind of tries to control his movements and what he does. But she's never bitten him. And, you know, we always say, geez, we're just going to get rid of that dog. And our son says, no, leave the dog alone. There's nothing wrong with her. But
yeah, this sounds like a could be a potentially a pretty scary problem. Whenever anyone is adopting a dog, it's really hard to look into the future and say, what is my dog going to need to be exposed to now as a puppy to get them ready for when they're a 10-year-old dog down the road? Am I going to be in a wheelchair? Am I going to be using a cane? Am I going to be having children or grandchildren? And that's where socialization comes into play very, very early on. And I don't know. You said you weren't good trainers. I don't know if that's part of it. But, you may not be able to go back if she doesn't associate kids with being, you know, fun and safe. You know, I would be recommending a couple of things. One would be having your son maybe be a little more involved in caregiving, having him be, feeding the dog, maybe not having the dog on a sit stay, you in control of the dog, he puts the food down, so now he's the bearer of all kinds of good things. I would also be recommending that because of her natural instinct to herd, because she's a border collie, that you'd not have your son and her in that situation where he's running around and encouraging her to chase, because that's just encouraging a bite. I think sometimes it comes down to controlling the child in those situations as well as the dog. But, you really do need to do that as well. I think in this situation, working with an applied animal behaviorist, working with those situations around the door and so on, it sounds like your son is pretty mature for his age if he's able to just, you know, blow everything off. But, you know, is he going to start having friends coming over that are going to, you not know how to behave in front of her? That's what I'm really worried about, is your liability. So I think you need some professional help. Mm. And I would get on the phone today rather than putting it off and say, you know, get somebody out to your house to actually witness the interactions and see if they can help desensitize her to the presence of your son and her, make her think that kids being around are a really good deal, because I get whatever it be, turkey, my tennis ball, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. Good luck, Ed.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And we have a comment from Jerry in Appleton. Can you recommend a good place to go for Pat vasectomies?
Ah, well, first of all, I have to question why they're wanting to do a vasectomy. Vasectomies obviously are just going to control whether they're able to reproduce or not. You are still going to have the testosterone and everything there. And so behavior problems will still be an issue. You're still going to have a dog that may want to fight with other boy dogs. You may have a dog that wants to roam and look for love. You may have a dog that's humping and so on. But we also have health problems. Prostate disease in the intact dog is definitely a big problem. Testicular cancer would be another one. And then all the testosterone-related tumors and things like perianal gland tumors, perineal hernia would be another thing. So there's some health problems associated with it as well. In my 33-year career, I've had one owner request two vasectomies, and both of those dogs, after being vasectomized, needed to be neutered for health problems down the road. And so, you know, we don't do it very often, but I know we do them at the veterinary school. If that is something that you are, you know, sure that you want to have done, if you just want the presence of testicles without the hormonal implication of having that, there is a product on the market, not that I'm advocating it, but they're called nudicles. They're fake testicles that can be implanted into the empty scrotum after neutering, so the dog has the appearance of being an intact male, but all the parts are gone. And I really have a hard time wrapping my head around that, because it's done for the person, not for the dog. But if that's the case, then by all means, go ahead and size your dog up and go ahead and buy them. They even make them for cats and horses. So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, and they make keychains and all kinds of things that you can get with the little nudicle on it. Yeah.
Oh, man. Susan and Miss. I don't know. What do they think of next? Oh, boy. Susan and Racine does not have a nudicle question,
okay.
I don't believe. Hello. How can we help you?
Hi. I have a 3-year-old Yorkie Shih Tzu mix that we adopted about a year ago. She has this crazy thing where we have a backyard that's, you know, fenced in except for one little spot. And if we take your eyes off her for 1 second, she heads to the other side of the house and into the street.
Oh, so much fun.
and walks down the middle of the street. And we when we adopted her from this place, that's how they said they found her. They found her walking down the middle of the street. Well, obviously, traffic was stopped.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is take your eyes off a second. We had her even jump into some people's car.
Yeah. Well, I don't think your dog has a death wish, to be running out into traffic. It may just be that your dog just doesn't have the concept of what a street is and how dangerous it really is. And I think it comes down to, you need to dog-proof your yard. That spot that she can get out of needs to be corrected so that you have your dog safe in a secure area where they're not going to be able to get out on the street. If that isn't possible, you may want to look into some of the electronic fencing that can be either home installed or, as I recommend, getting it done professionally, because there's a lot of training involved, a lot of troubleshooting and so on. And when you get it done professionally, they'll be able to come back and help you with that training over and over and over again to be able to keep your dog safely in your yard. So that would be my recommendation. Why she wants to go in the road, I don't know, but I think it just comes down to probably training.
Yep. Good luck. Thanks, Susan. Bonnie in Minocqua, your turn. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a 13-year-old healthy cat that has no desire to go outside whatsoever. How can I tranquilize him to take him on a three-hour ride? It's either a three-hour ride in the car or leaving him home for 2 weeks alone.
So why do you want to tranquilize him to be in the car? What does he do in the car?
He will yelp and sit up and make a mess.
Okay. All right. So what have you tried so far? Have you tried anything else?
No, I haven't tried anything. We have a cottage up north, and we're gone for 2 weeks at a time now, and I hate leaving him home alone.
Yeah, I think he would enjoy going up there. A couple of things I would be recommending. One would be, work on getting your cat comfortable being in a carrier. Often the carrier is the thing that triggers the reaction to what's going on in the car. So getting one of those top-loading carriers that's roomy and, having it in the living room, even if you have to dismantle it and just have the lower half there, put a blanket in it, put some treats in it, and have it be this really neat, fun place to be. And you can start training your cat to kennel up by, again, tossing some cat treats or something in and using the words kennel up, and your cat will start jumping in on its own. Having them comfortable in the carrier is the first step. Then out in the car. I think for not feeding your cat prior to travel will help cut down on the ammo that may be coming out the other end. Perhaps even using a big enough carrier that you can put a small litter box in one end may be helpful. Using feel away spray, it's the facial pheromone for cats, on the blankets and things inside the carrier, that may help. And then we start looking at, drugs. There are over-the-counter products that are, I call it the beer, tea, and turkey treatment. It's usually chamomile and hops and tryptophan. They're herbal-type remedies that may have some calming effect that are very safe to use. And you can buy them at local pet stores and online pharmacies. Then we get into some of the other drugs that are not quite as safe to use. There's things like acepromazine, which is a sedative that it was going to knock his socks off for a good 10 to 12 hours. And so you have to use it ahead of time and then be prepared for the fact that he's going to be pretty wobbly for the rest of the day when he gets up to the cabin. Then you can start looking at things like the Valium-type drugs. There's rare reactions that cats have where they can develop a severe fatal liver problem with it. A single dose usually is fine, but when you start getting into multiple doses, then we get worried about it. But that would be something that between you and your veterinarian, you'd have to decide as to what level you need to use. But really work on getting a carrier that he's comfortable in. I think that's going to be the first step.
And good luck, Bonnie. Thank you very much for calling. And Dick in Oak Creek, you have a quick question.
Hi there. Two real quick questions. One of our cats, whenever she walks on, her tail is always up in the air.
That's a happy cat. That's when you see kittens, they always do that to kind of show their anus, like that anal presentation to their mom. Just a real happy, confident cat.
Okay. Secondly, is this a wives' tale? If cats' noses are cold and wet, does that mean they're in good health?
No, not necessarily. That's just an indication that the humidity level or temperature, and so on. The nose is one of those areas that they do sweat. It depends on the humidity and so on in the air. So you can't really base temperature and moisture level of the nose on health. That is an old wives' tale.
Right. Dick, thanks very much. Sandy, thank you so much.
You are welcome. It's always fun.
She will be back tries to come on the second Tuesday of the month. So June 11th is her next appearance here. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Tomorrow, June is Invasive Species Awareness Month. We'll talk about invasive plants, among other things. Thank you very much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.